of things that have occurred to us that we're trying to straighten out in our thinking.
You know how you mentioned about how Moses was intercessing with God about not killing the people and
yeah.
all that? And then you said how that was a learning process for Moses. But when I was thinking about it, I mean, it didn't seem to me that God would have been any less righteous if he decided to start all over again.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I was just thinking maybe it was more like Moses learning that, I don't know how to put this, it's like, you know, God has every right to do what he wanted, and by
yep.
not, like, but if he chose to, like, start all over again,
yep.
he would be righteous as well.
Yeah.
Okay, one question is, by not killing everyone, was he less righteous? And two, was it just an illustration that he was just a totally merciful God by just killing 3,000 out of the, like, hundreds of thousands?
Yes, right. So what is it saying about God's righteousness that he doesn't
yeah.
carry out the first threat to wipe out everybody?
Because I don't see that as being less righteous, because he's God and he can do whatever he wants.
Yeah, is it less righteous to have wiped out everybody? There's a question there, isn't it? Partly it comes back to the issue of righteousness that we looked at yesterday with Abraham and God, that I think there's a danger if we say that God can do anything he wants, we're slipping into a slightly Islamic view of God, whereas Abraham is saying, no, actually, God's righteousness is a real righteousness. It's not simply what God wills is righteous because God wills it. It's that God actually wills what is righteous. And so there is a sense in which God's behaviour conforms to a standard. Now, that opens up a whole can of worms that I don't want to try and go into in an answer that's going to be too long already. But so I'm cautious about the idea of saying that whatever God had decided to do would therefore be right, although God would decide to do what is right. I'm sure that whatever God decided to do would be right because God does what is right. It's not because God has decided to do it. It's because God does what is right. Now, then what is going on here? Well, yes, the option surely would be there, just as God chose Abraham to be the beginnings and origin of a nation, so God could certainly choose a Moses to be the beginnings and origin of a nation. But Moses himself points up the issue here, doesn't he? He says, what are people going to say about you? Look, God brought this people out into the wilderness, you know, he brought a bunch of duffers. They turned against him. I've forgotten the chapter. What was the chapter we were in for that one? Was it 32? 32, Exodus 32. Yeah, that God says to him, why does your wrath burn hot against your people whom you brought out of Egypt? Why should the Egyptians say, with evil intent did he bring them out, to kill them in the mountains and consume them from the face of the earth? You see, this is going to be a problem. And he goes on in verse 13, remember Abraham, Isaac and Israel, your servants, Jacob that is, to whom you swore, saying, I will multiply your offering. He's actually calling God back to his covenant. So in fact, Moses is, in a sense, just as Abraham did, he's got the front to challenge God's righteousness. But of course, it's the thing God is waiting to hear from him. You're quite right. It's my covenant, isn't it? Now do you see? My covenant commits me to this bunch of losers. In fact, worse than losers, because they really are sinners. It's not me, thank goodness. It's one of the few Bible passages I've been moved to tears by whilst preaching. Because you see this thing of God, you know, Moses, God brings the people out of Egypt, rescues them, brings them to Sinai, makes this fantastic promise, you will be my people, you will be my kingdom of priests to serve me, though all the earth is mine, I've chosen you. Moses goes up the mountain, he's only gone a week or two, and they're into idolatry. It's a terrible tragedy. But out of it comes the realization that God sticks with his people and is a covenant God who, when he shows himself to Moses, reveals himself and says, the Lord, slow to anger and of great goodness. And so it's a learning thing. So I think things like, what if God had, are kind of hypotheticals, you know, questions that, yes, what if God had actually trodden on the serpent in Eden before the serpent had got as far as talking to Eve? You can ask a what if, but you have to deal with the what actually happened. So the righteousness of God, in a sense, is revealed through this. But yes, in technical terms, God could have done the other. So I don't know if that's enough of an answer.
More confused.
That's fine. That's good. Confusion is good. Confusion will make you think. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry if that is more confusing. But
sorry, just a quick question. Yep,
go on.
Is it wrong to think that God can do whatever he wants because he's God? Because you're saying that that's the Islamic way of thinking. Because I don't know, I've always thought that I'm like, I find it, I mean, every time I read the stuff about Moses and Abraham challenging God, I know it sounds very strange, but I find it impertinent. I'm like,
it is impertinent. I think you're quite right. I think we ought to see it as that.
God is God. He can do whatever he wants. Yeah, like, who are you as a mere creation to say, God, I can't do that?
I would say you've got it. That's the whole thing. When you read these passages, instead of this sort of pious church voice and Moses said to the Lord and, you know, Abraham said, what if there are 50 righteous? We should be reading this thing. This guy's really putting his neck on the line to stand in front of God and go, you know, excuse me for saying this, but what if there are 40? You imagine Abraham, you know, what's going through his mind at that point? We should be shocked and amazed. But the message that comes out of it, and I think it's an important point, is God ultimately simply one who wills? And therefore, whatever God wills must be accepted as the will of God. That's the Islamic shape of things. You know, the will of Allah is what, you know, inshallah, we'll get home tonight. God willing, we'll get home.
As Christians, should we think as the will of God? I mean, there's a tautology, right? God wills what he wills. He is God. He has willed what he willed.
Yeah. Yeah, but in a sense, as far as I can understand it, that is the Islamic view of God and his will. Allah.
How should we think of what?
Well, the question, I think what the confrontation between, and as Jews as well, the confrontation between Abraham and God at Sodom and Gomorrah basically says that God wills what is right.
But the definition of what is right is God.
It's not what God wills. No, that's not the way around. That what is right is not that which is willed by God. Because what you have to think...
So that's an objective standard of what is right?
No. Now, that's the problem, isn't it? Is there an objective standard outside God of what is right that God must also sign up to?
Right is God himself.
That's right, yeah.
How can he will anything but himself? Yeah.
It comes down to... let me try and answer that. The answer, as I see it, is because of God's character... Not because of a set of standards. That what determines what God does is not a set of standards of righteousness, but that God's character is righteous. And therefore, what God wills will be the right thing. That's not quite the same. There is a difference between that and saying, God wills what God will, and that must be accepted as right. Because that says that God has, as it were, a blank sheet of character. God can write on his own blank sheet anything he determines. And that becomes, saying is it right becomes a non-issue. The question is it what God wills? Which is how I see things in Islam. The question is not, does Allah do what is right? You know, when the Quran says in the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful at the beginning... You have to remind yourself that God's compassion is not your compassion. You can't compare God's compassion with your compassion, because nothing can be compared with God. There is no comparison possible, nor can his mercy be compared with your mercy. So whilst it is obviously right to say, because it's in the Quran, Allah is compassionate and merciful, what is the content of that? You could not imagine Muhammad standing before Allah saying, surely Allah will do what is compassionate, that is to say, what I'm talking about here, not doing this action. Muhammad would say, whatever Allah does, that is the compassion of Allah. Whatever Allah wills, that is the mercy of Allah. Slightly different. But we're saying that God has a character which is righteous. And the thing is, of course, what God's character is not is evil. And if it was evil, things would fall apart. So it's a different understanding of what we mean by God and his will and his righteousness and so on. But hopefully that sort of touched on some of it. Yes, over there, I think there was a hand over there.
I was just going to say, just following on from that. So these passages are teaching both Abraham and Moses and us.
And us, yeah.
About the character of God.
Yes, yeah.
Let's move on. Other questions or thoughts or comments?
Why the ritualistic slaughter of bulls and things? What was the idea behind that? Was it just to remind people who they are and where they stood with God?
It's partly a reminder. It is partly, you have to remember also that in their context, these slaughterings, the sacrifices, were effective. Because the relationship that's established always between God and his people is one of grace and faith. The grace is God reaches out to them. So the grace is shown in the fact that they're brought to Mount Sinai in the first place. They're not brought to Mount Sinai because they've been behaving themselves in Egypt. They're brought to Mount Sinai, as Moses reminds God here, because of the covenant. It's in also in Exodus 2, at the end of Exodus 2, where it's talked about the trouble they're in. It says, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. So grace first. Grace brings them to Sinai. And then they are given there the basis of the relationship between themselves and God. So the response that requires is faith. And faith is simply here doing what God has said you should do. So when you offer a sacrifice in faith, in response to the grace of God, it is in that sense an effective sacrifice. Because the relationship with you is being maintained as it should be. It is just keeping a faithful, trusting relationship going. However, the point that's made is, but of course, the real deal cannot be those sacrifices. They bring home to you, constantly reinforce to you, the significance of sin, the importance of sin, and so on. You also have to remember, as I said, that those sacrifices were not actually wasted. The useful bits were used, and actually mostly used by the Levites, who of course didn't have an income. So from one point of view, there was a sort of good byproduct anyway. But in terms of their spiritual significance, they were effective insofar as they were expressions of faith.
Now, I don't know much about the Jewish religion, but they don't do that anymore.
They can't do that. That's right. Well, they can't because they haven't got a temple. And you were only allowed to, again, it's a critical point in the Old Testament. When they went into Canaan, they were told, you're not to set up lots of different shrines, you're only to have one shrine and it will be where I tell you. And that was on the Temple Mount. And of course there's a slight issue at the moment in that the Temple Mount is occupied by the Dome of the Rock, and you probably have World War III break out if they flatten the Dome of the Rock, which creates all sorts of interesting speculations. But yes, they can't do it. Also, actually, I'm not even sure they could safely say that they could identify a priesthood to carry out the sacrifice, which is another problem. Now, yeah, don't want to go further down that road because we're getting into lots of discussions about the significance of Israel and so on. But that it's a real problem. What do? When they have their Passover, you don't have a lamb. You have a lamb bone. And it's there as a token of, you know, there ought to be a Passover lamb here. But of course we can't have a Passover lamb because there's no temple.
Clearly as history, why did that happen?
Sorry?
Clearly as a
There was a Jewish rebellion in around 70 AD, and the Jews had been a bit of a pain in the neck to the Roman Empire generally, and the Romans, I think it was Trajan, does anybody know the emperor, Trajan? Who flattened, anyway, whichever one it was, flattened Jerusalem and destroyed the temple, and made jolly sure they didn't rebuild. So that's where it goes, 70 AD. 70 AD is a very important date for New Testament studies, because you'll notice in that Hebrews reading that it talks about what is being done in terms of sacrifices, not what used to be done. So that suggests very strongly it was written before 70 AD. Because the writer would have said, if it happened after 70 AD, the writer of the Hebrews would have said, look, it's all been trashed anyway. But he doesn't. He says, this is done there, so it's got to be a pre-70 thing.
So at Jesus' time, the sacrifices and everything was...
all still going on. That's right. Yes, because, you know, obviously it was still an option then as well. That's right.
Just leading on to that, when the sacrificial system was a shadow of what was to come, but also the Israelites could see it didn't work because they had to do it every year.
Yes, although I'm not sure they were convinced it didn't work. I think they were convinced that by doing it and doing it, you know, to the hilt, this really was keeping them in a right relationship with God. And of course the problem with all these things is you always slip over, even when it's set up on a basis of grace, you easily slip over in a basis of works, because you start to think that it's performance related pay, you know? And so you start thinking, well, you know, I have to say that in my job I have been involved in some quite complicated services, especially when I've been visiting certain kinds of churches where there's lots of bells and smells and, you know, people prancing around doing things. And there's a real sense of, you know, at the end of it, well, that went really well, didn't it? And a little sort of pat on the chest for all those that have made the service go so swimmingly well. It is inevitable that you start taking pride in your achievements. And so even though there's this strong grace element, you actually find in Jewish writings around this period and a little bit earlier as well, you find that people actually are subtly assuming works, even though the actual doctrines that ought to emerge from the Old Testament should be doctrines of grace. But actually, how well you've done in keeping the law does become a determinant in people's minds of whether you're accepted by God.
It takes back slightly to the conversation around the character of God. And it's striking you use the phrase that God needed to be reminded of his covenant. And just to pick up on that phrase in particular, does that mean that God's slightly fallible, that he needs reminding from Moses or Abraham of what his covenant was?
No, but, you know, when I pray to God, I tell him all sorts of stuff he already knows. You know, if I'm describing my encounter with God, then what you'll get is my reaction to God. And so I may speak to God with reminders, but God, you have said. You know, and sometimes that seems appropriate. Why are we in this poo when God, you have said, you will be faithful, you will deliver, and so on? Now, it's as much a description of what's going on with me and my situation. Well, in fact, it's entirely a description of that, isn't it? None of these things can be seen, as it were, as being probes into the condition of God. You can't, as it were, send a probe in. You can only express where you are and say, but God, what about your covenant? You remind God of his covenant. Does that mean God had forgotten it? No, because clearly God can't forget. Presumably God can't forget in that sense.
In the passage of Exodus 32, 11 to 14, it says he relented from the destruction.
Yeah, but you'll remember I did talk about that earlier, that when we read these things, what we're seeing is the different reactions and responses of God to the different changing situation. Yeah. So it's quite appropriate to say God turned away from this action that was proposed. It is proposed, and it's turned away through Moses' intercession. It's the old thing about prayer, isn't it? Does prayer change God? If the answer is no, why do we pray? If the answer is yes, how on earth can we change God? There's a bit of a conundrum, but nevertheless we do pray, and we expect God to answer prayer. And so here you have God speaks to Moses. Moses, as it were, prays. I mean, that's all he's doing, talking to God. It's just prayer a little bit more up front than we normally do. And prayer is answered. It's in that sense no more of a mystery than when you pray for something and that's answered. You know, did you change God then? Well, he's going to help me out here.
He seems to have stated his direction, his will.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to wipe him out.
Yep.
And then he does something different.
Yep.
We don't normally get that. With God has moral will. Mm. By saying to God, is it all right for me to do such and such? God tends to reveal his will through his word.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. I think that's simply a difference between, a real significant difference between where we are and where they were. Here is, you know, real nose-to-nose confrontation with God. And things happen there that don't normally happen to you and I. But the dynamics of it, I'm simply suggesting, I think the dynamics aren't terribly different from when we do pray. That is to say, we speak to God and we convey information and we make requests and we treat it as if it was a conversation, which when you sit back from it and think, well, actually, what is going on here? You know, there are big questions people ask about prayer, but you shouldn't ask too many because you just stop praying. It's like riding a bike. How am I staying on this bike? Don't ask too close because you'll fall off. The important thing is keep pedaling. You know, so with prayer, the important thing is keep praying. But it doesn't hurt occasionally just to say to yourself, isn't this an interesting thing that I'm talking to God? As if there's the classic illustration that somebody said they heard a prayer that began many years ago. Surely, Lord, thou hast read the Manchester Guardian this morning. You know? But it's so easy to fall into, isn't it? But we think it's funny, but so many of our prayers aren't that different from it, are they? Lord, we bring before you Mrs. Smith's leg. You know.
We're going to stop there if that's all right. Let's carry on discussing this between ourselves and picking John's brain. James is going to lead us in prayer.